It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, we are back fighting to clean up the public discourse waterways, get rid of the invasive species, make the water safe once again for the ethical talkers. That's all we really need out there is ethical talk. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer. I'm a rhetormedian, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. On the podcast, I talk about a few different things. I talk to comedians quite a bit about their politics and their careers. I convert conservatives because the right concerns me. If you don't think I need to be concerned, well, convince me. I'm always open to good persuasion. And I chat with persuasion pros, cause havers, people trying to get stuff into the world because they've got ideas and they'd like to have those ideas heard. And of course, rhetoricians and rhetoricians in training and people who are rhetoricians who don't think they're rhetoricians yet. My guest today, really good dude. I've met him, I guess, over the last month or a little bit longer. We've talked a few times. I was on his podcast recently. He's the host of the Culture of Things podcast. He's a much sought-after management and leadership consultant. And from Australia, Brendan Rogers.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me, mate.
Yeah, I think we got to rename your country, Australia.
Australia, I love that.
Where the bosses come from.
Oh, where the... Oh, well, at least it's full English. It's not the sort of Aussie or the slang that we put on it, the Australia. Australia.
Yeah. You know, my kids lived there for 6 months, so I have a little bit of a connection to Australia.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it's one of those places. I have a bone to pick with you guys for sending us Rupert Murdoch, but everybody else seems pretty cool.
Isn't Rupert American now?
Ah, that's fake. That's right. Reagan just touched him with a scepter and now he's American. He's not American. He's clearly a foreigner. He has no love for this country. It's just a big piggy bank. He could care less what he says.
It's a fair old piggy bank, isn't it, mate? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mate, did you notice what I was doing during the intro?
No, were you moving? Were you?
I was, mate. I was. I learned from the best.
Nice. So for those who don't know, Brendan has signed up for my course and he's reading, I think he's read the book and all that good stuff. So some of these rhetorician ideas are starting to infect his brain a little bit.
Mate, they are. And I think what you referred to in the introduction, the rhetorician in training, I think I like that tag. I've taken your advice. There are a couple of bits of advice that came out of the interview that I really liked. And one of them was about sort of owning that rhetoric, the rhetorician tag. I think that's really powerful. So I think I can link to the rhetorician in training side of things. And I think the other thing that resonated with me a hell of a lot, which is something we just spoke about before you hit the record button, was that becoming a producer as opposed to a consumer. I think they were two sort of really powerful statements that came out in our conversation that I reflected on and thought, well, I really loved how you even referred to the producer versus consumer and said, you know, I'm not sure if I'm ready to be this producer, but everybody else seemed to be okay with it. So let's go with it. I love that mindset.
Well, so, and you've jumped into it. I mean, you've got a podcast, you've got, I assume when you do training, leadership consulting and training, that you have a particular program variation that you use that's somewhat unique to you, you know? So all those things become, right, your content, your bag of content that you're sort of Santa-ing around the world and trying to get out there.
Yeah, mate, absolutely. It's such a mindset shift, isn't it? Really, that's the thing. There's so many people out there doing wonderful things and sharing wonderful content, creating all sorts of stuff. But if your mind's not in that game about, again, stealing your terminology, being that producer versus consumer, we've got to consume to produce. But if you can shift that mindset, again, you know, since you and I have spoken the first time and then on the podcast, it's, you know, those couple of things have just changed my thinking a bit. And it's made me think a lot more differently about how I'm writing certain things, how I'm putting sequences together in the work that I'm doing and how I'm trying to systemize my own business and the way that I try and talk to people, you know, just being that little bit more thinker and be a bit more rhetorical or take that rhetoric approach. So it's been fascinating. I'm a massive, I love to think about myself as a continual learner And, you know, learning's great, but it's really nothing if you don't action what you're learning. So, you know, I don't always get to action a lot of the stuff because I need to make sure I stay focused and prioritize on things. But when I come across your sort of stuff and you and think, well, rhetoric, communication, effective messaging, like that touches everything. How can you sort of put that aside and ignore it? To me, I just couldn't.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things when you find little metaphors like that, sometimes. So I was an academic formal educator for a long time. That has such a strong structure. If you're in a semester or a quarter and it's a course and it goes through these 15 weeks and you meet 30 to 45 times and it goes through a progression. And that's all this kind of super structured learning versus the stuff out here that you're doing, like on podcasts and courses that people can buy and things like that. To me, it's like, I sometimes think of it as like you're walking through a field and you're in the field of rhetoric now, right? Like it's this big open field somewhere between a couple of mountains of politics and whatever business. And you're just walking through there and you just like, what's that? And you just kind of pick it up and it, cause it's gleaming in the grass, and the rest of the stuff is there, but you pick out these nuggets that have some type of energy for you, some type of clarity. And that kind of, I call it epiphany learning. You know, when you find those moments and they stay with you, I think those are the easiest things to bring into your life outside of that field.
Yeah, absolutely. As you're talking there, I had this vision of Russell Crowe in Gladiator walking through the field and just sort of, you know, touching the flowers and sort of feeling his way and sensing. And it is, again, my minimal experience as a rhetorician in training, that's exactly what it feels like. You just, there's all this stuff around you. You're starting to look at things through a different lens, I guess, in some respects, an upgraded lens. Again, you talked about it when we spoke on the Culture of Things podcast, that it's dangerous when they're, you know, when we're sort of using rhetoric or people using unethical rhetoric. Maybe they don't realize they are, but they're not, their mind is not trained. You know, they don't know what they don't know. And I think it's a powerful thing once you start to unpack this stuff. Like I said, I'm a massive fan of, if I can focus on some things that have a massive impact. Very similar to, I guess, the work that we do. You know, you're producing a lot of stuff and it's fantastic stuff and it's always a good read, and, you know, but it's to the masses. And even the way, as we said, you price your courses, just it's about getting it out to the masses. And I think that's the thing with me and the mindset around understanding this rhetoric. It's something that just touches everything. So if you can understand it, your book is fantastic, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. You know, moving around the arenas, start to practice some of this stuff. And to be fair, you don't even have to try to find scenarios, right? You can practice it every single moment of the day because you're always communicating with someone, or you're thinking about something, or you're writing a message. So it touches everything, mate. I can't believe that I didn't know anything about this earlier. I'm 46 now. I've sort of lived a sheltered life, I think.
You've been protected existence. Rhetoric couldn't get to you.
You have opened my eyes to a whole new world.
Well, I think when I look at your stuff, like I was doing research about you today before we jumped on here, and the idea of management and leadership, right? Would you say those are your two primary terms in your business?
Yeah, yeah.
Teamwork.
Hopefully I'm working more with leaders than managers.
Yeah.
Sorry?
So your terms like teamwork, leadership, and is management in there? Like, what are, so one of the things
culture,
you do in
rhetoric
is collect your God terms. That's what the God terms and devil terms, right? And so God terms are the terms that you've plucked out and that are your, you know, term uranium, and you use those a lot. So what are yours? I found teamwork. I found leadership a lot. And
yeah, there's two. And the third one is really culture. You know, culture is that personality of the organization, as a friend of mine calls it. So, you know, there's management is a part, but management is a necessary part of anything when people are leading people. You know, you're in a role where you're leading people, you're still having to manage process and manage things. But the higher you go up the tree, supposedly, you should be spending more time on leadership, i.e. focused on the people. You know, we can unpack some of that, but focus on the people.
Talk about that to me. What do you see as leadership? How do you define that?
Mate, very simply, for me, leadership is about you're in a privileged position of serving others. It's no more difficult than that. And that's going back to mindset I mentioned before. You know, it's a real mindset about, am I in this role as a serving others, helping others succeed, helping my the individuals in my team work as a collective, interact well, really focus and harness their energy as a team? If I'm an effective leader, again, I love what you talked about in rhetoric and how you explain it to your kids, effective messaging, because I use that term effective leadership. There's effective leadership and ineffective leadership. Effective leadership to me focuses on the people. Ineffective leadership focuses on self. So people are in my team to serve me, to make me look good. And you know, things like humility come into that. You know, do I put myself ahead of others, or I put others ahead of myself? Again, the sort of leadership I like to work in, to me, is the only form of leadership, in that people are there to serve others, to help them grow, to help them develop. Coaching people, you know, helping them really embrace their role. And I guess, to pick a God term, which, you know, I'm not saying I'm a massive fan of this word, but that whole engagement, right? That's a word you'd hear a lot probably in the circles you deal in business. But helping people to really enjoy their role more, be more engaged in what they're doing, you know, understand what they do like doing, and how they like to work. And if leaders can help garnish that out of their people through the overarching umbrella of genuine conversations and having relationships, then, to be honest, the technical side just, you know, doesn't matter too much. You know, we're in a world of shiny new things, aren't we? You know, great leaders don't need to focus on the next shiny new thing. They get back to the old principles of people, focus on people, build relationships with people, help them interact better, and help them develop as people and trying to be the best that they can be.
So that's that's an interesting way of looking at. Again, I drag everything back into rhetoric, but one of the strong things that I've noticed when I do business, especially, is interpersonaling as a rhetorical tool. Like, if you understand interpersonal technique, and there's a whole list of them, and we all use them naturally, but then there's the formal kind of study and advancement of them. So it sounds like, for you, like, part of the things that you define as good leadership is the ability to read people, to listen to what they want, and then to adjust to them. And that kind of interpersonal structure of that the other becomes primary and important, and you're there to try to get them to their goals, as opposed to, you know, forcing them to the goals that you think they should have. So, I mean, that seems natural to you, interpersonal structures. Like, you seem really comfortable with that. Like, that's who you really are.
Mm. Yeah, it's authentic for me. You know, I'm not trying to be anyone different. Am I perfect? Well, no one is. You know, have I busted up relationships? Have I said the wrong thing at, you know, the time where it's not appropriate? Yeah, absolutely. It's probably more so with my wife, as we spoke about on our episode, I think. But, you know, it's relationships are an authentic thing to me. And going back, mate, to what I talked about in this whole world of looking at the world from a rhetoric perspective now, is that leadership touches everything. You know, you don't need to be having people that you're leading in a team, in a business, to be a leader. You know, people will see you as a leader, or they'll not see you as a leader. You know, they don't want to aspire to what you're doing or follow the behaviors that you're exuding and stuff like that. So for me, if every individual on this earth can actually be more comfortable in their own skin, and, you know, A, have some awareness of working that out, and then building a life that enables that to happen, then, you know, we're in a pretty good place, aren't we? Again, I don't need to wake up in the morning and think, well, how am I going to act today? I'm just, you know, relationships are foundational. I always try to have an element of self-awareness around my relationship building, because if I don't have that, then it does damage relationships. If they're seeing me as person X and I'm seeing myself person Y, then, you know, there's some incongruence there, which is, you know, not true self-awareness. So relationships, again, one of the core, I guess, phrases I use is that the relationships will determine, the quality of your relationships will determine your success and your failure. And I think that's something I learned from a very young age from my own parents, you know, the quality of the relationships that they've had for a long time in, their sort of church side of things. You know, they're sort of born Catholic. I guess a little bit of your background, mate. You know, I'm not sort of visiting church each day, but, you know, I have some beliefs there, I guess, that, you know, have gone through me with, you know, since a young age. And my father had his own business for a long time. They've been in, you know, strong relationship circles. You know, some of their friendship groups they've known for a very long time. How I got my first job was off the back of some of the relationships my father had in that industry. So, you know, you just can't underestimate the value of relationships.
Yeah, I agree. And from rhetoricians are accused a lot of times of being a Machiavellian or plotting everything or overly structuring things, being inauthentic. And I always tell people that's bad rhetoric. If you're doing that, if it's that artificial, that's just bad rhetoric. Good rhetoric is, I know that there's power in creating good relationships with people. There's value in it. And so I want to get very good at creating good relationships. And that means the more I understand what a good relationship is, like, how do I define it? How do we break it down? What are the sub techniques in there? The more I practice those, the better I get at it. And therefore I create better relationships. Therefore I'm a better persuader.
I mean,
so
what
where
do
did you
like
learn to how to be like, where did you learn interpersonalism? Is it just naturally learned, or have you taken courses in relationship building?
Yeah, I'm going to take a term from you, you know, drop that natural bit. You said to me, like, forget that professional, it just comes naturally. It's not natural. You know, I guess the environments you've been in have impacted that hopefully in a good way. So I was back in 2004, I think it was, around that time, early 2000s, and I became very interested in the whole emotional intelligence side of things. I'd been playing football for a long time and made my way into semi-professional teams, you know, earning a little bit of money, but certainly not enough to live off. So I always loved that team environment, and to be in a team environment, you've got to get on with people, right? There's so many different types of people. And it's not that any of them are bad. They just have different value sets sometimes. So, and you need to be able to move around those arenas, for want of a better word, in building relationships, understanding people. I captained teams from a very young age. So how to get the best out of people. I guess I learned through that process of maybe high-pressured football and performance. That gave me a really good foundation for taking that into business. Did I realize that at the time? Probably not. I don't think I did. But then, said early 2000s, I got very interested in this term, emotional intelligence. I think it was a bit of a buzzword or buzzwords around that time. And I was able to go on an emotional intelligence course from, you know, one of the high-level organizations in Australia. And we did a 360-degree feedback process as part of the pre-work of attending the course. And I got feedback, again, sort of anonymously, I suppose, through, you know, friends, family, people I worked with, people I led, my own bosses above me, and, you know, those friends that, you know, I interact with on a personal level. And what was startling to me was that there were so many different aspects to what people saw as who this Brendan person was. So I was sort of maybe chameleon-like, and I wouldn't go back and say I'm being inauthentic, but I had this professional hat on in business, and that was quite a serious professional hat. But then I had this sort of joker laid-back side where people sort of knew me personally, which, you know, they didn't see me as that real serious sort of type. And so I was sort of living a double life, I suppose. And I just, for some reason, I felt that joker side didn't work too well in business. So that opened my eyes to the fact that, who am I? Like, what is this person? Like, that seems like hard work that I'm this person in this environment, and I'm this person somewhere else. So that really opened my eyes to the possibilities of what is this stuff. And off the back of that, I just became a massive consumer of all things personal development. So I read stuff. I started to see things through maybe an upgraded lens, and I tried some stuff. I always like to, if I'm going to do something or read something, I like to put into action. And mate, geez, I screwed up some stuff. I screwed up some action. I read some stuff, and I think this is why there's so many leadership books out there, right? Because a lot of them say the same stuff in different words, but the thing that's missing is context. You can't just grab something from these fantastic leadership books and say, well, I'm going to plug and play, because when you're dealing with people, there's all different contexts around this situation. And if you can't read that situation, if you can't read that context, well, you're really going to struggle around your relationship side of things. So natural, with a bit of learning, with a bit of screwing up with relationships and making poor decisions as a leader because of my own sort of beliefs, and not sort of thinking what might be the, you know, what even the team wants, and shutting some of that stuff down. So a hard road. And this is why I'm really passionate about what I do, and that whole leadership development, democratizing that, because if I didn't have the will to learn myself and be really self-reliant, then I probably would not have wanted to lead people for very long. It's like, this is too hard. I don't want to deal with this crap. Just let me come into the office, do my stuff and go. But that wasn't me either. So, you know, I needed to find a way myself. And along the way, I have had help from business over time now. But, you know, I think a lot of leaders who potentially would be great leaders don't have the opportunity to be great leaders because they get into leadership positions and they're not ready. They haven't been trained or developed. It's sort of learn on the fly, and some survive, a lot don't.
Yeah, I find that it's fascinating listening to you talk about your own development within the concepts of this kind of interpersonalized leadership and that flavor of leadership. And I think it's natural to a lot of people, this idea that good relationships allow you to be a good leader, right?
They set a solid foundation.
Yeah. And when you pull that into other contexts, like politics, that's not necessarily true. Like, it's really hard to lock politicians down into being good people, and to be use the interpersonal contracts that people use everywhere else. But I think business does adapt to it fairly well, to that model, especially modern business. You're hearing this a lot from everything from diversity, you know, to sort of progressive institutions and organizations. When you compare that to, I don't know if you've seen, if you watch Succession.
No.
Okay. So it's supposedly based on the Murdoch family, the Fox family. And it's essentially a soap opera set in a super high corporate environment, and they're just constantly plotting against each other. It's a family, and they're just, the father is just a horrible, horrible Machiavellian human being, and he just constantly destroys the family by throwing bombs everywhere and lying and not rewarding people when he says he is, and so they have to plot back against him. And in that world, trying to be a nice person and doing what you're talking about would just make you pray. Like, you would just, all the predators would just chew you up and, you know, be done with you. How do you feel about that? Like, do you think this is a strong enough, do you need organizations that choose, like, yes, there's value in this approach, and this is the culture we want, this kind of, you know, sort of nice person, interpersonalism, trying to do good things in the world culture, versus, like, I worked at Fox for a couple of years, and it's a toxic, mean-spirited environment. So do you stay away from those places? Do you pick and choose, like, where you think your approach works best? Or,
yeah, look, you have to, right? Because you know what it's like in the consulting type world. It's not their problem. It's your problem. You're the person that hasn't made it work, let's say. So, you know, it's, you want to pick a fight that you think you're going to win or that you've got a chance of winning. And so, you know, I don't, take, unless I've already got a relationship with somebody and that's developed over some time and I feel like I know the person, that's when I'm comfortable taking on work. But, you know, there is a process of building a relationship before we feel, I need to feel that this person has some the right mindset, you know, that they are actually coachable and want to be coached and they want us to expand their mind into things, or they don't. And if they don't, then that's not a good client for me. You know, it's not going to work well. It's not going to end well. So organizations and leaders have to be deliberate about what they're doing. You know, culture is a deliberate thing. Okay. If you aren't deliberate about developing a culture that you want, then you will develop a culture that you don't want. Things will just naturally fall and people will start to, if they don't know what the goal is for the team, as an example. So if they're not working together as a team on something, and leaders, I believe it's leaders' responsibility to help that team understand, you know, what are we focused on as a collective? If people aren't going through that and in a deliberate way, then people naturally move to looking after themselves. I mean, to me, that becomes a bit of a natural thing. You know, I want to look after my patients. Not that I don't want to do a good job, but I'm going to do a good job in something that I think I should be focusing on and I think I should be doing. And that's really where politics, which is what you're, you know, and I don't mean politics from the, you know, the normal politics, politician side of things, but office politics comes in. You know, people start shuffling their dices. They want to, you know, they want to smash other people because they're trying to get ahead of others. And yeah, you know, the unfortunate reality, mate, is that that has been termed leadership for a long time. To me, that's not leadership. As I said at the start, leadership is about putting others before yourself. Not putting others before yourself, you know, and really, that is where you become that skillful politician. Either you're in politics or you're in an organization where you're always moving the chess pieces. You're probably becoming an unethical rhetorician. You're manipulating, you're moving people around. And sometimes people like that are very good with people. They're very good at building relationships. And that's when it's really, really hard to identify them, because it can take some time to weed out the fact that, hey, seems like they're making decisions or they're doing things that benefit themselves as opposed to others. But they're so good at having those relationships and moving the chess pieces around the board that they can be very, very hard to spot, but also very, very damaging to the idea of teamwork. Extremely damaging. And Fox would be absolutely no different to so many other organizations, big and small, where, you know, skillful politicians have risen to the top because organizations don't address behaviors over time, and those behaviors are being rewarded. So it's like raising kids, mate. If they're doing a certain behavior and you keep rewarding that, but you don't like the behavior, how could you think they're going to stop it? Doesn't make any sense. That's what happens in organizations a lot of the time.
Yeah. So these environments get very complicated very quickly, right?
Oh, tell me.
So one of the things I like to use a lot of times is this concept of beacons. And I talk about this when I work with businesses trying to build their messaging. Mm-hmm. Like you need to set strong beacons up on the mountain. And if you don't, then everybody below, everybody downstream, everybody who's got to do work later on is not going to know what to do or be. And it kind of sounds like what you're saying. Like if you start out with the beacon of, hey, we're going to work as a team and everybody needs to be good to each other, not to just yourself. Like that's a pretty strong beacon to set.
Absolutely. The stronger that beacon, the stronger the teamwork. And you know, I would imagine in the environment that you've lived a long time and, you know, project type stuff, even on your podcast, you talk about a lot of these 13-week contracts and stuff like that in the space you're in. Like people are coming together and I would imagine there's a very strong beacon there. Like you're wanting to achieve, you know, some outcomes over X number of episodes or for a certain show or whatever. So you're harnessing all of this talent in a room and people are looking at the problem that you're trying to solve through their own lenses, but there's still that beacon of what we're trying to do. We're all focused on the collective good and we're all going to take different paths. And ultimately that's where there needs to be a strong leader in place that we can garner, we can dig into Dan, what do you think about this? You know, Rob, what do you think about this? Mark, what do you think about this? Okay, great. And then when you've got a group of people in a room like that, you're not after consensus, right? Consensus is really just a soft thing. Oh, yeah, we sort of agree, we sort of buy in, but we're not really. And if it turns to shit, then we'll throw our hands in the air and say, oh, I didn't really want to do that anyway. We're after commitment. And if people are really committed behind that cause, and we can really extract people's input into the process. And then we, because people have input into it, somebody needs to make a final decision. Okay, thanks for all that input. This is fantastic. I'm going to take this and this is what we're going to do. And 9 times out of 10, people get behind that because they feel they've bought into the process. And that piece of gold, again, I've heard you refer to this, that piece of gold is sitting somewhere in the middle. It's not solely Dan's idea. It's not solely Brendan's idea. It's not solely Mark's idea. Often that's not the case. It's a collection of those ideas coming together, which has formed something even greater than what we could have done ourselves. And hey, that's the power of teamwork. If you harness that, you know, that collective is so much better than, you know, the individual. Even if you've got a PhD, mate, you know, bringing the people together is still going to be more powerful than you on your own.
Yeah, and I think that is, like you said, the promise, that's the rhetoric of teams, that the collective is stronger than the individual. You run into a lot of weird things in different industries with that, like in entertainment, that the individual is really held up as a strong force in entertainment, that they're the auteur, the original voice. They have a vision for this that's pretty unique and original, and that's what makes it work. And everybody else is there to service that. Not in a way of just, you know, I'll do whatever I can, but in that they set the original beacon. And I did this a lot when learning how to write for other comics. I've got a good ear for other comedians. Like, I can hear their voice in my head once I hear them do their stuff, especially if they have a strong character. And so once I have that as my beacon, I can just write in their voice and get it fairly close. They still have to adjust things, but it's because that individual's voice is so strong and so clear and so unique that the group can come together around that. So I've always found it kind of fascinating, like the original work, again, in Hollywood, you break everything into a pipeline model. So you start with concepts, and the conceptual work usually comes from the originals, the originators, the original creators of something. Seinfeld and Larry David did this together. They created a unique kind of comedy because of, you know, Jerry Seinfeld was very easy to get and clever, and Larry David was very dark and very absurd. But together, that voice created something unique, and everybody saw it. And then the writers just filled it every week. And so I think, like, when you actually do both of those, you've got that good, strong, iconic individual, and then they allow the team to come along behind and coalesce around it. Seems to work pretty well in my world.
Well, absolutely. I think it works well in every world. You know, teamwork is not an industry specific thing in my books. You know, yes, you can argue the toss in sales type environments that, you know, maybe there's not a strong need for teamwork. You know, there's maybe individual performance goals. And again, it's not about not having individual performance goals. People still need to perform as an individual. They need to be very clear on what their performance is, what's expected of them, all of those sorts of things. But whatever that looks like, that needs to be part of the greater good in what the team's working towards. So in, I guess you could say, traditional type sales environments, you know, they often break up into, you know, a state base or a region base or whatever. And, you know, they're sort of measured up against each other, that, and then at the end of the year, there's, you know, big prizes that salesperson X has, you know, best real estate salesperson in the field. Well, you know, I would argue, and I do have some real estate clients, that, you know, they do value teamwork, and they're bucking the trend, so to speak, because they believe in what I believe in, that if you have one person who's a star performer, then that's okay. But how do we harness that as a team and help everyone else be star performers? Because obviously what that person is doing is working. It's pretty good. Let's, you know, get that. Let's codify it, understand it so that we can help all of them be that. Because overall, then all of a sudden you've got an environment where it's not one person producing $1 million a year. You've got five or six people producing $1 million a year. I mean, that's a far more powerful position to have as a team and as an organization, even in a sales environment. So, you know, it's teamwork is, it's a life sport, mate. I think just like rhetoric, it's a life sport. It's everywhere. It touches everything. It's just the mindset that you take about it. If you take a deliberate mindset, you'll harness the power of it far more easily.
So how do you, again, rhetorically thinking about you and what you're trying to do as a guru, thought leader, you know, leadership expert, all these things that which make you prominent and visible and hireable and desirable to organizations. You want to be known as the super individual, right? That's part of the game in credibility and ethos building, is that you want to seem special. Like there's something about you particularly that is special. And you can, it can be teamwork or it could be whatever you pick, but like, what do you think it is about you that, because I have a lot of friends who work within the corporate kind of interpersonal space. And I've got a friend who does, she does Reiki and 9 million types of yoga and everything else. And she comes in and she's very steeped in her stuff. And she has a PhD in communication. So she has a lot to offer, but it feels like she's floating into the room. You know, she's like, ah, here she comes, you know? And it's really cool to see because it mesmerizes certain people. Mm. They want that offer of somebody who can kind of harvest from all that sort of new age approach, bring it down to something that works for organizations. Like she does a lot with trauma. She talked about the trauma of the pandemic and helping organizations recover from that. And so she has that kind of approach. And she wears flowing kind of clothes and stuff to make herself, again, this. What is it about you that when people see Brendan Rodgers that lifts you up as a central character in this narrative of nice guy leadership?
Yeah, well, it's a really, it's a great question, mate, because for me, it's no different to what you, some of the feedback you gave me on the podcast and through the conversation we had. I'm just being me. Now, I need to be comfortable with that. And I need to be comfortable with the fact that there's some people that don't want to spend time with me. You know, maybe I'm too boring. Maybe I'm too conservative. Maybe I'm too leveled. I don't know what it is. But the thing that I provide my clients based on the feedback from my clients is fairness and independence. And as a consultant, you need, In the space that I play in, you have to have that. You know, you're dealing with people, you're dealing with emotions. Yeah, sure, there's a few models and tools and techniques and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to me, that's the stuff that you just need to call on in a certain situation and the context of the situation. Understanding the people, understanding the relationships, the ability to not get dragged into the emotional side of that, which is very, very difficult. You know, we all have a bias and you know, emotions are high in some of these situations. So in my DNA somewhere, and again, I can't say I've had therapy to really understand where that comes from, but I have an innate fairness trait in me. I need to be fair about things. You know, I can tell you when we had two, we went to the, this is a silly story maybe, but this just supports my need for fairness in the world. So we pretty much have two of everything, two kids, we had two budgies, two dogs, two cats. Like there always needs to be that two of something. We never really set out to get two, but whenever you're there, it's like, oh, they need to have a mate that's fair. And then even when I'm feeding them, you know, I can bend over a schmacko, which is, I'm not sure what they have in the States, something similar, but little meat treats. And I've got to fold them in half to make sure that it's halved fairly and give one to one dog and one to the other dog. Now, my life's a little bit easier now because we have one dog left and one budgie. But you know, there is just something in me that provides the fairness side of things, and my innate need for logic over emotion allows me to create some independence. And that has been the strongest point that my clients give me. Yeah. Again, maybe there's some other things, but that always underpins things. I treat people fairly. At least I try to treat people fairly. I like those equitable situations. I love being that person that takes the view of people and try and harness that and facilitate that in a process to help leaders get great outcomes and then celebrate that with people. I mean, I did a lot of swimming as a kid, and you know, again, reasonable high level swimming, and it was great. I enjoyed the process of swimming and the discipline around swimming, but there was always something missing. It wasn't a team sport. You know, once I started to play football, played some rugby, you know, and then even did tennis as well, which is more of an individual thing. Yeah, sure, you play doubles, but at the end of the day, there's no one to celebrate that stuff with. And you know, there's so much power in coming together as a group and creating a community to do stuff together. I mean, you can hear it in my voice, right? I get excited about that shit.
Yeah, for sure.
I am a community builder. Mate, you know, it's through our networking events. It's not about trying to, you know, bring in the big wigs from the area. You know, we've got some really great people on the Central Coast, and you know, they're doing fantastic things for business. But sometimes our networking environment maybe is not for them because, you know, there's no price attached to it. There's a lot of small business owners, and there's not necessarily maybe the esteem attached to being part of this networking group versus say a BNI or a, you know, one of these highly paid networking groups. And that's okay. It's not that these things are wrong groups. It's just they appeal to different people. I'm about, you know, I don't want to put barriers in place for people, especially in business, where they need help, but they can't afford the help. So all of a sudden there's a barrier as soon as you put a price tag on something. Again, I need to charge for my services, otherwise I don't live too well. That's the reality of business. But wherever I can help it, I try to provide as much value as I can for as little cost as I can.
So you're the fairness guy.
I try to be pretty fair, mate. Yeah, absolutely.
So this absolutely. is my rhetorician brain working for you, thinking like, okay, if I'm selling you out in public, like right now you don't really have God terms and devil terms. You have kind of somewhere in the middle terms, like vanilla terms. So management, leadership, and things like that are used by teamwork. It's used by a lot of people.
Yep.
So what a rhetorician would do is come in and say, let's see if we can get you some flavor that distinguishes you. So a set of language, you know, a rhetoric storm that is Brendan's, you know, uniquely. And a lot of times that's what they're trying to do with slogans or naming and things like that. They're trying to come up with a unique isotope that will glow in the middle of the storm. It's that you are the beacon. And they can instantly say, oh, you should talk to Brendan Rogers. He's the fairness guy. It's like, well, what's that mean? He's like, well, he's really good at coming into organizations and settling things down because people feel like they've been treated unfairly. They're in unfair teams. They're in unfair systems, and injustice is one of those things, like you talk from a cultural perspective, that will destroy a culture. It'll destroy employees. It'll destroy relationships. If they feel something is unfair at any level, on any dimension, that destroys the culture.
Absolutely.
Not saying you should do this, but this is what I would start doing, is plucking out possible isotopes and saying, does he like this one enough? Can he make money with this one? And do people like it enough so that it's, you know, and is it unique? Can it compete against the rest of the people who are doing management training and leadership training and things like that?
The fairness guy, Dan, I do like that. It's pretty simple to understand. It's not too much of a buzzword. So you and I have had a number of conversations now, and you know, both sort of face to face and on email and stuff. So what else do you see in that? Because again, it's always about how people perceive you, right?
Yeah, it's really about trying to figure out how you want the people of value to you to perceive you. It really doesn't have much to, it's not that important the way people see you right now. So if you told me, like, here are the kind of clients that I want and the kind of corporations I want to work with or groups I want to work with, I'd be, okay, awesome. Let's look at them and what are their hero characters? And would fairness be strong enough for them to go, yeah, we really have a fairness problem here. We need to talk to this guy. Or would teamwork, like a teamwork specialist, like you are the world's greatest teamwork creator, something like that, where people are like, well, what's that mean? We definitely need, you know, our teams, a lot of people hate each other here. We should bring that guy in. teamwork has been used so much that I would probably keep pushing linguistically to find you an original or a more unique version of that word. So that, again, it kind of has beacon value or isotope in the hurricane value, so that people go, oh yeah. And maybe fairness would do it. I don't know. But like that's the process of doing linguistic work for people like you have strong approaches, and you clearly have a strong idea of what you want to do with when you come into work with people. Finding the essentialized, the shortest, most intense, you know, high glow version of that becomes really valuable when you know, talking to people out in the world who don't know you.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think we have similar problems in our worlds, in our storm, Dan, because the teamwork, like rhetoric, gets taken in a bad way, as you said. You know, it's just rhetoric, it's empty rhetoric or whatever, you know. So there's a negative connotation to that. It's not necessarily a negative connotation to teamwork, but the definition of a team versus a working group. Like we naturally, when we put people together in a, let's say, a business environment, and I'll put sport aside for a minute because that's a simple concept. But in business, what we naturally do, and I've done it many, many times myself, is there's a group of people that have come together, so we call them a team. And actually, for them to be a team, a real team, like we said before, I didn't use this term, but there needs to be some collective goal, that beacon you refer to. If you haven't got that, you have no team. You're really just a group of people that are working together, but you're really doing your own thing, what you think is right. And I'm not saying those groups don't work. I'm not saying they can't perform well, but I believe they'll never perform to their maximum because they're not harnessing the collective good. So people screw things up, really, is what I'm saying. You know, whether it's capitalism, socialism, you know, whatever it is in the world, it's, to me, a lot of the time, it's not the system, it's how the people use the system, or it's how the people define the word, and they start to move the definition, and the word sounds great, but they lose the fabric of what that word actually means. And maybe that's where our, you know, the worlds or markers put us together, and the two worlds are colliding, and I'm starting to understand, or hopefully starting to understand the words better, or want to understand the words better, because people take things out of context. They redefine words that were never meant to be defined that way. And again, if we can just harness that and articulate that better, then it's that awareness, right? People have an awareness. If you don't have an awareness, how can you do something about something you're not aware of? It's just not possible.
Yeah. And this is the super work of rhetoric. Like I call it, I have all these files that are named FS files, foundational symbols, and finding the foundational symbols that will work for what you're trying to do. You know, it's one of those things that people don't really understand the process of sifting and sorting and resorting and resorting, the development process. Like I leave the word rhetoric in my stuff because it's an old word. It's not been worn out. People don't really even know what it means. Rhetorician's even better because they've never even heard that word and they can't say it. And so it's got a certain power to get people psychologically involved. And then I immediately grab it and say it's the old Greek word for persuasion. And then it's completely redefined. And I'm like, and a lot of times in culture now, it's left on its, you know, sort of 1/10 of the negative stuff that, you know, rhetoric does, but 90% of it's ethical, you know, rhetoric. And so it's got value. It's not a perfect word because as soon as people hear it, they feel confusion, but not in a bad way. They feel curiosity and confusion. They're like, well, what is that? And then I've got them, you know, and that getting an emotional response that drives people into dialogue really is the secret. Those two pairs are the secret to rhetoric. I need to get a kind of an emotional cognitive response that drives people into dialogue with me. Once they're in dialogue, I can use all my other script, the whole bouquet of flowers, but I can't do that until I get them into dialogue. And that's what you're kind of bait out in the world is. It's like, it's just drifting out there. And it's like when people run into Brendan Rodgers, your name's not particularly spectacular. It's not different. It's an ordinary name, right?
I'll let my parents know you feel that way.
Brendan's, Brandon's, Brondon's, Bronson's.
It's just vanilla flavor, mate. I'm just vanilla. Like,
which is fine. You know, like you can find ways of turning almost anything into a, I look at things as assets, deficits, and liabilities. Mm. That's my original way that I break things out from a communication perspective. What assets do you have? What are your deficits that you're missing? And what liabilities do you have? Mm. And with you, you clearly are a nice person. Like it is so pristine in your communication that it totally backs up what you think, what you're saying about the type of leadership that you want to sell and teamwork that you want to sell, which is great. I mean, that seamlessness is a really powerful thing.
Yeah. Thank you, mate. I appreciate your feedback. The, I guess just to track back on what you're saying, you know, it's how you explain sort of rhetoric and then persuasion. It's, I understand what you're saying. Like the fact that culture, leadership, teamwork, it's almost like people have already got their definitions of those, whether they're right or wrong, but they have a so it doesn't necessarily lead to further questioning, I suppose, that they've already got some perspective in their head. Whether that perspective is right or wrong, I wouldn't always know because it's not leading into something else. Whereas I know even just through the process of us developing a relationship and even deciding on a, not a topic, on a title for our interview was the art of persuasion. Not because I wanted to call it that and didn't want to use rhetoric, but the reality is that on the searches, mate, people are searching for persuasion a lot more than what they're searching for rhetoric. So exactly what you say, I experienced myself. Like, what is this rhetoric? And even through the interview you and I had, like I interchange rhetoric, persuasion quite a lot. And when I spoke rhetoric, I brought in persuasion and stuff like that. So if I'm reading what you're telling me, then yeah, that culture, leadership, teamwork, yeah, they're foundation, but how do I get something that creates further interest, I guess you could say. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, an emotional and cognitive hook.
Mm.
And that's the problem. And I see this a lot with business because business, a lot of people use the same terminologies across businesses, and teamwork and leadership and, you know, things like that are very, very common words in those worlds. Mm-hmm. And so when people see them, they have no emotional or cognitive effect anymore. Mm. It will tell you a little bit about what you do. Like you see leadership consultant or teamwork consultant, people are like, okay, I've heard a lot of guys, you know, say that. And then you can distinguish yourself if they will get into dialogue with you from mm-hmm. there. The question is if you're trying to attract new people, if you're trying to become a, you know, sort of a very neon guru in the world, how do you take this stuff that you have to offer, which is, I'm thoroughly convinced is valuable. Like I have thoroughly convinced anybody that would bring you in would get good culture work, good leadership work, teamwork. I think they'd benefit from it. When you're putting that bait out into the world, bait is sparkly. Bait is super tangy. Bait is something you can't ignore. And it can't just be you, unless you're a weird, crazy, spectacular character, which every once in a while, you know, then you'd be in Hollywood. That's what they hire. That's what they pay or construct, you know.
Hollywood's not my thing, I don't think.
Well, you'd be surprised. They're like Bryan Cranston essentially is you. You know, Bryan Cranston, Breaking Bad.
No, I don't. What you learn with me, Dan, and sorry, just to interrupt, is that I'm focused in my world, which is a good thing. But the bad thing is that my wife is the bigger world. She's the wanderer out of the two. So she's a lot more worldly and outside of the, you know, I can talk leadership, culture, teamwork till the cows come home, as you know, but outside that world, unless it's got something to do with Liverpool Football Club in the EPL, I live a sheltered life, buddy.
That's funny. Well, there's probably a soccer player I could mention, but I don't know those, you know, I don't know soccer at all.
Well, you know, David Beckham, because he's pretty famous in the States, isn't he?
Yeah, that's the one soccer player I know. And Pele, he was Pele, around.
Yeah.
And there's another guy. What's his name? The one that's famous now. There's a couple of them that are famous.
Messi?
Yeah, Messi, that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't pick him out of a lineup, but I know his name. Well, like, I pull up pop culture a lot because there's so many characters there to look at. But Bryan Cranston is this super nice guy. He played the lead in Breaking Bad. And that's what he sells, nice guy-ism. Mm. Like, if you ever look him up, he's a super nice guy in interviews. I've never heard a bad word about him. It's like Tom Hanks. And you're in that genre of nice guy. Like, if I'm looking at you as a character, and what do we do with you as a public character, that's probably where I start. Nice guy. And, you know, again, that's kind of a mid-range. That's not going to get a ton of, then you amplify it somehow. You know, the world's nicest leadership consultant. Like, what's that mean? Exactly. Now you got him in a conversation.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. It's interesting. I've got a session with a lady this afternoon who's a friend of mine, and we've actually never met face-to-face because of the lockdown situation, but we met during lockdown, and I call her the model queen. She's been on the podcast a little while back. So I've never been a person that's seen myself, going back to sort of your language, that producer side of things. Like, yes, I know that I am. I'm more conscious of that now, but... Yeah, you know, a lot of the theories, a lot of the understanding of what I've spoken about today, it is scripted, like you've said. I mean, I've learned from people that I resonate with and like to do, and now moving that into my own flavor, for want of a better word, is that I now feel like I need to move ahead with designing my own flavor. You know, I feel that I've done exceptionally well out of, you know, taking a slant on stuff that I've consumed over time. And now I feel a lot more confident about continuing to, you know, take a bit of that spice and a bit of that spice and a bit of that spice and making it into my own sort of recipe. And that's, so I'm, you know, again, timing is unbelievable, I think, in the world, isn't it? How things come together. It's that mindset shift in the last month since sort of meeting you a bit more and having met this lady a few months ago and developed a solid relationship. And we got a bit of time together just to say, what does this Brendan model around, you know, cultural leadership teamwork look like, and, you know, the foundations of underpinning, and to me that it's pretty simple, but to me leadership is simple, the concepts are simple, it's the action that's very challenging, it requires extreme discipline, but the focus is people, the focus is putting those people into the right roles and them understanding what they're passionate about or not passionate about, what motivates them, what demotivates them, how they interact together, how we do that, people working together, you know, not trying to outdo each other, but actually, you know, harness that collective good. The discipline around that, so whether that's meetings, whether that's individual performance conversations, whether it's people understanding their role, you know, there's specific disciplines around that. And then, you know, maybe the nice guy approach, you've got to wrap that up with genuine conversation. You've got to have a solid enough relationship where you and I can give each other feedback and I'm not walking away thinking, oh, God, Dan's a knob. I don't care about his feedback. Like, I value the feedback because we have a relationship. That's what underpins all of those four earlier pillars I mentioned. If you can do that and you can focus on those five things deliberately as a leader, you're well ahead of the game.
Yeah. And I think, like I said, I think the core of your system is solid. It's cognitively solid. I can see the value in it. Trying to turn it into, so there's this weird division now that you see with private life and public life. They merge in the digital. There is no longer a perfect private life. Everybody has a public digital presence, whether you want it or not, but nobody, 90% of the people of the world are not ready to move into a public self. They don't know the difference in their private self and their public self. They know it like in sort of lived experience of you dress better at work, you don't say certain things at work, but there's a real world script. And then there's the media, digital, public world script. And most people never really live over here. And so they end up trying to import all this stuff here. It's the first natural move. And you said it earlier, it's like, I'm just myself. I'm like, well, that's great. But if I'm your executive producer or your rhetorician, you know, consultant, then I'm like, I don't need a regular self. What I need is a character who can exist well in the public cyberspace and get attention and draw people into dialogue, because that's what's going to make you money. And so we start looking at you and doing development, like, what is it about Brendan that, you know, we can, because you want to stay authentic, and most people do. It's not necessary, by the way, for public sales to be authentic. It's just, that's a private demand. Public demand, like, you see this all the time, again, with Hollywood people, they are not who they seem to be, but they're very good at being in the public and seeming like the person that is really interesting and kinetic in public. But that's, most private people don't like that feeling of being inauthentic. Politicians, Hollywood people, they don't care. It's like, I'm playing a character and that's what I do. And so I don't tell people, when I advise people on this stuff, I don't say like, yeah, learn to be inauthentic because that's going to win over here. I prefer to do this kind of bridge, which is what most people want, is that let's find things that are natural to you that we can amplify over here that you still feel comfortable with. That's why, like I said, with you, nice guyism is one of the first things. But even like when you're saying teamwork, leadership, and culture, like that's TLC. So that's an acronym for, you know, tender, loving care. Like, you start to find assets in your communication that can maybe live over here, you know, and they can be captured from your natural stuff, but you just got to find the right ones that will glow in the dark, or like I said, glow in the storm, no matter what's going on around it. People will still go, oh yeah, you know what? We got all this stuff going on. It's called Brendan. Remember that guy? He nicifies cultures.
But you're good at what you do, aren't you? I mean, how long have I been talking about teamwork, leadership, teamwork, leadership, culture, and I've never thought of the acronym TLC.
Yeah, it's the linguistic brains. Like, my brain just puts together words and characters and things like that.
Hey, it's. I mean, it is just a classic example to me again of, you know, leveraging, building relationships, call it, you like, you know, whether it's commercial or personal, whatever, but, you know, bringing in the right people to help you at the right time, you know, it's paramount in anything. And, you know, again, you guys talk about script writing and stuff, and maybe there's that character at the front of the episode or the front of the late night show or whatever, but, you know, that character is nothing without the people behind the scenes making stuff happen. And if you've got the best of the best in each of their areas and they know exactly what they need to be doing, it's pretty hard to get a poor outcome. You're going to get a pretty good outcome, aren't you?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Like, when you really, and again, that's where leadership comes in. You've got to be able to pick the right people. And if the wrong people are in there, you have to be able to move them out of there so that you can bring the right people in. And you have to be merciless and somewhat brutal, not to that person, but in service of the product. Like, yes, you're a wonderful person, but I need a better writer right here. I need, you know, somebody, I've only got 4 writers. I can't have 3.5 pistons firing. So I need great at every position if I'm going to get great outcomes. And that's the thing, you know, I think, again, across different industries and things like that, you have different leadership needs. That one, I've seen people do it really well, like what you're talking about. I've always had really good bosses in Hollywood, guys that were very interpersonal and very kind, but I've seen them fire people right and left, you know, because they're like, it's not me. It's, you're not ready for this, or you're not, this isn't the position for you. And so it becomes part of that culture where it's not taken, you know, as an affront usually.
And it is to me, it is a special skill. And, you know, that's an area that we haven't spoken about at all today, that, you know, a massive part of leadership is actually what you referred to. You know, you've got to know when you've got the right people, but more importantly, you've got to know how to understand to get the right people to start with, it, you know, a filtering process through that. But then knowing when you may not have the right person and making sure you're having the right conversations. You know, I'm not an advocate of saying, well, you know, Dan seems like the wrong person, I better just bring him in and, you know, I'm going to be nice about it or kind about it, but you're no good here. Yeah, you know, you need to go through a process of unpacking that to some extent. Sometimes the time frames are shorter than others, but, you know, you need to be courageous about the conversations you have sometimes. And that is the, you know, that is true leadership as well, right? The foundation of that, most people in leadership positions a big problem is they're not having the conversations they need to have. The best outcome, as I say at the end of the podcast, the best outcome is always on the other side of the genuine conversation. And that outcome, that best outcome could be the fact that, hey, you're not ready, you know, it's not quite your time, or you know, whatever that is. But if that's the best outcome and you do that in a respectful way, then you know, people shouldn't feel bad about it, because you're helping them move into a space that either a different space altogether or a different part of the, you know, different role on the team. I remember an old boss of mine. I've had some fantastic bosses, leaders over the years, and I've had some poor ones, but I've learned from all of them. And this one guy that I have, he was almost like a second father to some extent, is how I explained him. But, you know, he just, there was a deep care. I felt like I mattered to him as a real person, first and foremost. So that was always a big tick. But the guy could deliver news to you, whether it was, you know, he needed to have a genuine conversation with you about something that maybe you're not going to sort of like, or something you do. Like you always left just feeling cared for. And yeah, he could have ripped shreds off you, but he did it in the kindest way possible. And you just loved the guy. You worked for the guy. You did everything. But you knew where you stood. You knew what was good performance and maybe what wasn't quite good performance, and where he expected better of you. And that made you perform much better as an individual.
Yeah, I think all that clarity, you know, clarity of information, conversational skill, like all these different things that play into this. Again, it gets very complicated very quickly. And, but it is like, I think your special brew of this, I know there's a special brew that you've put together that is Brendan Rodgers. I know it. And I think when you find that and you find the way to communicate it clearly, you know, to the public and your public self and your public scripting, it's going to match the quality of what people get when they have a private experience with you, when they actually bring you in. And I think you'll see some real synergy at that point. And that's the super offer of a really well-developed public self, is that it brings people to you, you know, just because it communicates so well and captures so much of what you want to offer and explains it to people. They're like, I need to hear more of this. And you know, I can just see you brewing on it and see you starting to build it. And it's cool to watch.
It's such a journey. Isn't life just a journey? Like, it's, you know, where I was, I've had my own business since 2015 as a consultant in this space. And you know, I had a bit of a hiatus. I worked for a couple of years for a client full time, which obviously puts pay to serving other clients. But the whole thing has been a journey. Where I was in 2015 and my thoughts and ideas around stuff have, you know, they've not changed, but they've adjusted in a way that sort of started to align my style. I like to think I've lost a little bit of the corporate wank that I used to have from 20 odd years in corporate, and I've started to talk a bit more small business, real stuff that people like to understand and consume. You know, maybe I haven't lost it completely, mate. There's 20 plus years of undoing there. But I feel less of a corporate consultant. I feel like I'm more of a consultant for the people that really care about their people and have a bit of a self-conscious, you know, a social conscience in what they're doing as well as a business. You know, I seem to work best with companies, not just, you know, I have not-for-profit clients, I have for-profit commercial clients as well, a mix of both. But all of the business I work with have some sort of social conscience. You know, they are really, they're doing good things for the world. They're doing good things with their people. And that's, you know, that's very, very appealing to me. And I find people with that sort of mindset have a good mindset for leadership.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think that awareness of something outside themselves, the value of the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
It sounds like it jives up really well with the way you like to train leaders.
Very much so. Word you mentioned earlier, mate, is clarity. And that is absolutely, I think it's paramount in anything that we do, but particularly around this leadership space and particularly teamwork. You know, the worst thing you can have around teamwork is everybody leaving the room and not having clarity, but thinking they've got clarity and they're all going out into their space and moving in different directions. That's a problem. So, you know, people that value the fact that it might take a little bit longer, you know, we might need to be in a room for an hour or 2 hours or longer, but the goal is always, whatever we're working on, we've always got to have total clarity. And if we don't, people need to be safe enough to speak up and make sure that they seek the clarity that we need so that we can all move forward in the same direction. If we don't do that, then that leads to dysfunction.
Yeah, there are many pathways to dysfunction.
Isn't there?
And it's always lurking. It's like, stay away, dysfunction. We don't need you over here right now.
And mate, again, it's not a case of where is the perfect team? There is no perfect team, right? The All Blacks are, you know, very, very famous, the most famous and the most successful sporting team in history, the New Zealand All Blacks. Well, there's still dysfunction in that team. They're a very, very high-performing team, but the difference between a high-performing team like that and maybe one that hasn't had the results that they want, they understand dysfunction. They can see it. When they see it, they have awareness to it, meaning they can see it. When they see it, they can do something about it, and they have the skills to do something about it. Ultimately, if you can do that in anything you do, once again, you've got a pretty solid foundation for improving and moving things ahead in a direction that you want to move.
Yeah, all good concepts, man. You're just throwing out the good concepts.
It's like we're just preaching to the converted, aren't we, mate? Both of us. I mean, I'm in the rhetoric bus and you're on the leadership bus.
More fun to preach to the converted. Like, talking to hecklers, that's no fun. Come on.
Well, yeah, as you said, mate, I would never heckle you from the back stalls of your comedy show because, as you said, it's not a fair fight.
Well, I don't like to let people become my enemy. Like, that's my secret to heckling is somebody will be something and I'll be like, are we fighting? Like, did I do something to your kid or something? What happened? Like, how did we become not friends? Because this doesn't feel friendly anymore. I had a guy heckle me once in Houston. I couldn't tell what was going on. And I knew something was coming from over here and the guy was heckling me in Spanish. And I'm like, hey, you can't heckle me in Spanish, man. I don't even know what you're saying. You may be saying you love me. This may be a proposal. Like, is this a marriage proposal? And, you know, and he never shut up. He was really drunk and he just kept going. And I was like, can anybody interpret or anything? And finally they had to kick him out. But I'm like, you got to heckle me in my language so I know whether to hate you or not.
That wasn't in the same biker bar you spent time in, was it?
Nah, that was different. I did a lot of the biker bars and country and western bars and stuff down in Florida, all the dive bars that would just, you know, bring comedians in for a night. But no, that was an actual comedy club. This was a nice comedy club. But
yeah, okay. How did he get through the door then? Bad filtering system.
You know, they'll let anybody in until they prove that they're a problem. And then half the time they'll leave them in anyway because they're buying drinks. I'm just there as a drink, you know, a drink excuse. That's all it really is.
Well, again, you've done all right over the time, mate, from what I understand. So, you're pretty good at your game as well.
Well, appreciate it. Super fun conversation, man. I appreciate you jumping on first thing in your morning and last thing in my evening. And
it's a pleasure. And, you know, again, you've said so many nice things about me over the time since we know, but you know, you are just you're a super fun dude as well. And the thing that interests me about you is you're interesting. Like, you are just, there just seems to be so many layers to someone like you and the journey you've had through your lifetime and just, you know, I'm hearing it through your podcast, the stories you've got, the interactions you've had, the experiences you've had, mate. It's it sounds fascinating. You're a fascinating dude, buddy, I have to say.
Well, thanks. It's crazy when you actually do a podcast, right? And you talk about yourself with the other people. There's like 125 hours of talk on that podcast now. So like, if anybody really wants to figure me out, like, yeah, I mean, it's all there. Sooner or later, you know, you'll say pretty much everything, especially when you're talking to a range of people. But fascinating, man. I love conversation. I love digging in things like this through conversation. It just gets more and more interesting to me the more variations we have of it. So again, thanks for participating in all of this. I appreciate it.
Mate, it's an absolute pleasure. There's many, many interesting people in the world, isn't there? It's just about investing time in people and taking the time to understand it, which you're doing. You know, I feel I'm doing in my life. It certainly makes for a far more interesting journey in life, I think.
It certainly does. And you know, it'd be interesting too, is to call Brendan Rogers at The Culture of Things, go to his podcast, go to his page, hire him as a consultant. Do you want to pitch yourself a little bit?
Mate, I'm the nice consultant. Huh. I'm the nice guy. Like, if you've got unfairness in your organization, then you need to come and speak to me because I drive fairness. I drive respect.
That's pretty good.
I'm very independent too. I don't get wrapped up in the emotion side of things. Fairness drives things.
I like it. Like you're like Willy Wonka of niceness. You come in and you like spread candy niceness everywhere to everybody. I like it.
Yeah, come and see me and I'll, you never know, the door C has the golden ticket.
Get your golden ticket with Brendan Rodgers. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it very much.
Absolute pleasure, buddy. Thank you for allowing me the time with you.
Absolutely. So this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, as always, get out there, persuade people. We all need it.